This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
I'm not thinking of any one particular individual or one organization. I've seen it actually in 15 years of my kind of public work. I've seen it in a whole number of places. This is where you have acrimonious invective thrown at each other, attacking people's reputations, perhaps slander, perhaps, you know, rumor. And so how do we resolve it? We go back to the Quran and Sunnah. And I know everyone says this, but what does that mean? We need practical, specific, technical solutions from the Quran and Sunnah.
Welcome to our special guest, Abdullah Andalusi. This is our first time in person together.
Yeah, alhamdulillah. I'm so used to seeing you through a screen.
Exactly, same here. But I follow your work and I admire your work quite a bit. I also admire your demeanor in how you approach your work. I think you're a very fair-minded and balanced person. And
it's just the accent, but it's
right. Yeah, you know, we assume neutrality in the British accent always. So, alhamdulillah. So I wanted to ask, in your opinion, what are some of the maybe obstacles, challenges that we face currently when in the English-speaking Dawah, US, UK, Canada, and in your mind, how can we move forward?
Yeah, so Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, As-salatu as-salamu alayhi kareem, Muhammad wa alayhi tayyibin wa sahbihi salihin. So thank you for having me on. I guess, you know, you're from the United States of America, I'm from the UK, so we met in neutral ground, which is Canada.
Yeah.
Right? So in essence, I don't live on the ground in the United States of America, and it's a big place. There are different Muslim communities in different areas. You've got those in Texas, you've got those in New York, you've got those in California that I visited. And each have got their own local dynamic going on. Mm-hmm. I've also seen the Muslim community in Canada, both West and East Coast, and also obviously in the UK. In the UK, the Muslim community dynamic can be different just 2 hours away because it's a small island, but loads of Muslims.
Sure.
Alhamdulillah. So the general dynamic which I see is that in the UK, currently, Muslims have been feeling under siege by the British government, which has been very meddlesome in Muslim affairs, mm-hmm. and has implemented draconian laws since the quote-unquote war on terror, or should be called war of terror. And so in such a situation, the Muslims have kind of rallied around each other, have kind of dropped the rivalries, which are seen to be completely irrelevant in the face of much more present danger from the British government, which isn't. We had recently a case in Birmingham where Muslim children were kind of taught books that were deemed to be pro-LGBTQ or promoting it as a morally equally valid lifestyle, mm-hmm. which is something that the British government or the school system shouldn't actually be getting involved in, because they're not here to talk about moral equivalences.
Right.
They should be talking about just giving you education as to maths, physics, chemistry, you know, PE, physical education. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so in the UK, it's about the da'wah to non-Muslims. It's about defending the Muslim community, collectively speaking. And our focus is generally, you know, outward. The kind of rivalries that used to be the case, we haven't seen since the 90s, early 2000s. But that soon kind of withered away when Muslims realized there was only fools fight on a burning ship.
Right. Know? So just detail for us, because maybe there is some difference to the context. Obviously, in the U.S., we have the Patriot Act. We have, you know, CVE, right? We have different sort of things. But what specifically changed post 9/11, post 7/7? That is an existential threat that is seen as a common cause to unite in the face of? What are the specific things that are going on?
I mean, it's an interesting question, the difference in the general mentality between US Muslims and UK Muslims. Somewhat subject to certain debates between, you know, analysts. I know the RAND Corporation published, I think it was Building Moderate Muslim Networks, and they themselves noticed this difference, that the Muslims of UK were more intractable and were harder to change or to pressure or to inculcate kind of liberal ideas amongst. As for US Muslims, I obviously won't make a blanket discussion on it, but the RAND Corporation seems to think that liberal ideas are more easily kind of pervasive amongst Muslims in the US, or they're more vulnerable to them. I don't know exactly why. The Rand Corporation proffers a hypothesis, which is that the Muslim migration to United States of America was mostly from middle-class backgrounds, mm-hmm. whereas Muslim migration to UK was mostly from working-class backgrounds or rural backgrounds. And so this difference in mentality led to a difference in susceptibility to liberal ideas. That you could make the argument that in England we have a small island and everyone's all up in each other's faces. There's no there's no space to kind of in a way completely separate yourself and do your own thing. Whereas in United States of America, a Muslim can, apart from going to their job, mm-hmm. where they might meet non-Muslims, they could, and maybe the supermarket, they could quite happily exist driving their car around and going to the mosque and going to their house, going to the Muslim neighbors, and not really interact much with non-Muslims, i.e. not have non-Muslims impose upon them or feel that they're being imposed upon by non-Muslims, mm-hmm. Pressuring them to adopt cultural norms, mm-hmm. What have you. So they feel that there's a lot more leeway. And of course, added to the fact that you have general comfort and success for Muslims in the US, where it's not unknown to have two cars, for example.
Right.
You don't have to be a millionaire to have two cars. In England, if you've got two cars, it's likely that you're approaching a millionaire, basically, because things are much more expensive down there. Certainly real estate is more expensive. American houses are much bigger than UK houses, just across the board. Mm-hmm. What to make of that? Does that play effect? Is it hard to hate the system that feeds you so well and, you know, gives you a nice big house and two cars? Is it the case that, US Muslims are just because they came from a different economic back bracket or background, or this is something which is a matter of discussion. I couldn't answer the question why there might be a different mentality and what that difference is, because you might find very stalwart Muslims in the US who are not compromising.
Yeah. My question was a little bit different, though. It was about actually from the government end, right? Sure. Like, what are the differences between what the governments of the United States and Britain are doing to their Muslims? Like, for us, I'm more familiar. I know that you guys have Prevent, right? I think that the LGBTQ curriculum in the UK is much more invasive, from what I understand, because with us, at least we have differences from state to state. So you have some states where it's no worries, and then you have other states where it's very, very heavy handed. Mm-hmm. So as far as government surveillance, as far as people getting thrown in jail, as far as ideological imposition, right? That's more my concern. Like, because this is what Muslims are coming together sort of and burying the hatchet, right? Burying their differences in the face of, right? So what are the specific things that are going on in the UK and do you have any sense of comparatively with what's going on in the US? Like, is it a bit worse, would you say, the pressure from the government, or is it a bit less that pushed this sort of at least attempt of unity?
Well, the United States of America has the First Amendment, okay? And so in the United States of America, you can say anything you want, within a whole bunch of limits. obscenity actually isn't protected under the First Amendment. Mm. So if a judge deems what you say to be or what you've communicated in some way, shape, or form to be obscene,
right?
Which depends on the local community's definition of that. You're not protected against some kind of prosecution or civil suit. Mm-hmm. In the UK, of course, there's much more restrictions on speech, mm-hmm. not just bans on expressing racial hatred, but also expressing hatred against LGBT people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now you can criticize, I suppose, the ideas of LGBTQ ideologies, which equate such practice or lifestyles to be morally equal to heterosexual lifestyles or heteronormativity, as they would call it. Mm-hmm. But there's a bit more. And that bit, which is that, for example, even if you would be arguing if you argue in defense of a proscribed group, a group which has been deemed to be a terrorist group, or it's called a proscribed group, that's illegal. Not that you're encouraging people to kill people, not that you're encouraging people to even join up the group, but if what you're saying is interpreted by a court and of course the prosecution, Crown Prosecution Service, to be supporting that group, that itself is a terror offence in the UK, which is very unclear. Of course, in the UK, there was the case of, I think it was a Muslim who wrote on his Facebook, all British soldiers should die and go to hell. He just said they should die and go to hell. He didn't say kill them. He just said they should die and go to hell. And they couldn't prosecute him exactly under encouraging violence or terrorism, presumably because it was it was written in such a form as they should just drop dead, I suppose.
Right.
But they arrested him and prosecuted him successfully under the grossly offensive kind of communications. Well, the act as an act of the Communications Act, and it was a crime of grossly offensive speech or text, which is a crime apparently in the UK. So there's a whole bunch of things that Muslims fall foul of the lack of quote unquote free speech in the UK. And at the same time, when the Islam is attacked, or when the Muslim community is demonized with speech which arguably could be of the kind that would be inciting hatred of a religious community, these are argued that this is just free speech and you should allow it. But when Muslims kind of respond more vigorously, we've felt the sharp end of the hypocrisy, whereby we get prosecuted for things that we were not allowed to say.
I see.
So we see the double standards quite clearly in America, because the First Amendment is deemed to be sacrosanct. Generally speaking, you can say a whole bunch of things. You can tell people to sign up to the most prescribed organization there is, and it's not technically illegal in the United States of America, as long as you yourself are not actually a member of that organization
or financial supporter, things like that. I think aiding and abetting is sort of the language of the law.
Yeah.
You know, if you're caught aiding and abetting a prescribed group, then that's a serious offense. But yeah, it has to be explicit support, and the support has to be more than just ideological, from what I understand. It has to be material in some sort of way.
But in England now this brings us to the crux. Here's a very clear difference. In America, the American government has put funds for a program called Countering Violent Extremism, yes. CVE. There's a V there, violent extremism. The British government took out the V and just said countering extremism.
Okay.
But that's quite broad. What do you mean now? Because if it's not related to violence per se, then a whole host of things could be deemed subjectively.
Flat earthers are extreme.
Oh, yeah.
In a way, right? It's just the concept is very plastic.
I mean, you could say vegans are extreme, you know, so at one point, depending on, again, it's very subjective. The Overton window, it shifts. And so on either edge of it, these would be deemed to be extreme ideas. So that faced a lot of backlash, and such that the British government failed to make it law, though they tried many times to make laws that could ban the expression of extremism not related to violence, arguing that it is a precursor to violence.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's like the Chinese justification. It's like, well, we knew that they would commit the crime, so we got them before we even did it.
So then Prevent then uses what we call soft power. So if it can't ban things outright by law, it can do a whole number of things to interdict Muslim speakers and organizations in the UK. So the Charity Commission, they put someone who was actually part of the neoconservative Henry Jackson Society, of which has made many of these individuals from these organizations. This organization has made many arguably very Islamophobic, blatantly Islamophobic arguments about the dangers of Muslims in Europe and what have you. They put him in charge of the Charity Commission. Now, the Charity Commission is one that regulates charities. So anyone that claims charity status is regulated by the Charity Commission. And while technically speaking, the Charity Commission doesn't have a mandate to remove charity status from organizations deemed to be extremist, not a legal one per se, they do harass and target disproportionately Muslim charities, and Muslim charities accused of hosting extreme speakers, quote unquote, according to extremism, or advocating extremist ideas, and so on and so forth. But they keep it nice and vague. What is extremist? Because although there was a kind of a few bullet points, criteria of what it is. It was very general. In essence, to summarize it, anything's called un-British, right? Mm. But it's very vague because what is British?
Yeah, of course.
Basically, you know? Yeah. So in that sense, that's where Muslims have been feeling the bite. Muslim events that are organized by either political parties or groups or speakers can be canceled because a prevent officer in the local region will call up the venue or get the police to call up the venue because the police will work with the prevent, of course, to simply dissuade the venue owner, like, please cancel this. This is a very, you know, dangerous event. And of course, we've also seen bank account closures,
right,
or suspensions or freezing occurring in the UK. So Muslims have been facing a whole host of measures of soft power interdiction, of harassment. And now I know in the United States of America, there was a case of entrapment by the FBI.
Oh yeah, and more than one.
Yeah, more than
all
one.
The time.
And of course the phenomenon of flying while Muslim,
yep,
right, in the US. But by and large, we haven't heard much of the same level of harassment and interdiction on Muslim events or organizations. I know that maybe mosque imams probably feel the pressure from government officials talking to them or breathing down their neck generally, mm-hmm, and they're quite squeamish anyway. But in UK, it's even more so, you know.
Right.
Mosques are renowned in the UK for being scared to host any events that talk about anything political, mm-hmm, at all whatsoever. Also because mosques have charity status too.
I was going to ask that. Okay.
Yeah.
So I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So, I mean, so that leaves us in a terrain where we're saying that, you know, British Muslims might feel the teeth of the law a little bit more, or at least now, because I think maybe immediately after 9/11, there was a peak. And then around 2015, when Daesh came on the scene, there was also another peak. And I think in the United States, it was more the situation of some cases, some people being made examples of, you know, and then sort of the message was sent, you know, but we're saying that perhaps British Muslims are feeling more pressure on average. And so this has sort of caused them to attempt to squash the differences between them. Has that been successful? What does that look like? And are there obstacles that are stopping that from happening in the way that maybe it should?
Well, I mean, I've seen Sufis, Salafis, Hizb ut-Tahriris, Tablighis, all these individuals that would have arguments and fights back in the day, share panels with each other.
Okay.
And also behind the scenes, there are talking shops,
mm-hmm,
between discussions, shura between them behind the scenes that most people don't see, that I have a window into, where Muslims try to coordinate campaigns, coordinate pushback against the latest British government harassment. There's things I forgot to mention, obviously, like the Trojan horse scandal, which was concocted, but it was widely believed, quite strong evidence for, you could say, that it was a concocted scandal by the government to clamp down on Muslims kind of influencing their own education of their kids in school. By claiming that there's extremism being taught in schools and schools being taken over by extremists,
right,
which was false, but many Muslim teachers lost their jobs from that. So, as I said, Muslims in the UK, we just realized eventually that there's no point. Fighting in a burning house? That's great. Mm-hmm. Is the correct kind of saying, and just to work together. Now you might get the odd Muslim here and there on Twitter, what have you, that will be making arguments and sectarian points now and again. But generally speaking, some of the more heavy hitters or the bigger names don't get involved in that.
I see.
Sectarian internecine fighting and bickering.
I see. Because I think a lot of people's experience and sense of, especially the online sphere, is that it's quite oppositional and it's quite sectarian. What's the way forward? Like, what do we do? How do we, would you say that the British situation is sort of a model, like that there has been enough success when it comes to unification and collaboration, that is something that, let's say, Canadian and American Muslims should be patterning themselves off of? And then what are the obstacles? What's standing in our way from having that actually happening?
Okay, so something I've been trying to champion in Canada and maybe to some, to a lesser extent in the United States of America, is having seen what Muslims went through in the UK and what it took for them to learn their lessons and mature, and realize that, look, we can still disagree and we can still express disagreement on the furu' of Aqidah and on discussions of manhaj and what have you, but we don't have to denounce, cut each other off, separate from each other, or leave each other to the wolves, or engage in slander or attacks, or trying to grab followers from each other like that child's game, Hungry Hippos. You know, the Hungry Hippos, where you press on these little plastic hippo things, and they the mouth jumps to go and grab like the food pellets in the middle of the game, as for kids, and each one has to compete with each other, just trying to hit the hippos to grabs as many as it could. And that was, in essence, I think something I see in Canada, maybe the US to a lesser extent. I have no idea about the US exactly concerning its reality. But when I went to many places in Canada, for example, I saw there was fighting and bickering between different organizations. It was especially in small towns or cities which are more isolated. There's a pool of Muslims, and everyone's fighting for their market share in Muslim adherence to their programs, to their courses, and so on and so forth. And it was ridiculous, because if your organization is doing something good, then you should rely on the merits of what you're offering to bring people in, bring people in through quality. And as the Quran says, for us to compete in the good. So, as Muslims, we should be competing with each other, but not by undermining each other or attacking each other, but saying, okay, you're doing something good. That's going to encourage me to excel and improve and do something better. And then that will then encourage you to excel and do something better. And then we mutually help each other to excel and improve, which is, subhanAllah, is a great, beautiful hikmah. Instead of actually undermining each other and attacking each other and viewing each other as rivals. And in the UK now, because Muslims are collaborating across different organizations, it's kind of somewhat irrelevant then which organization has how many adherents or which people subscribe to who, because we all work together anyway, And I think that's the hidden secret, is that if we're all going to work together anyway, then it doesn't matter who has which market share of what have you. And I've been trying to, where I have encountered some fitna in Canada, seeing rival organizations, groups, jamaats, what have you, have issues with each other, I've been trying to counsel them on the UK experience and say, look, in about maybe 10, 15, 20 years, you're going to probably realize this anyway. How about we cut all the pain out and just learn from the experience of Muslims that learned the hard way, basically.
Mm-hmm. Have people been receptive to that in your experience?
I'd like to say yes. look, there are many organizations that are, you might call, ecumenical. They look at the bigger picture. They look at the ummah, and they have a positive attitude, and they collaborate, and they even invite other people to go to other people's courses and other people's services. They not just us, but you also look at our fellow brothers here. They're doing some good work. So they do. There is such organizations in Canada. I'll name one because I'm particularly impressed with them. I3. Mm-hmm. They've always been trying to collaborate with others and encourage people to work with any other organizations for the common good when there is good to be done. Mm-hmm. But there's still a lot more work to be done in the Canadian sphere. And I'm not too sure, as I said, I don't have much knowledge about the US sphere, and I don't like to talk about things I don't have knowledge about. But if I'm just judging the US, I could only judge by the online chatter that we see coming from the US, the smoke coming from the off the horizon. And I mean, okay, there's issues, it would seem. There's obviously there are disputes and arguments amongst American Muslims. I think a lot of those tensions are due to the rise of left-wing fought and influence amongst Muslims in the US, and the tensions between those who are trying to oppose it and having difference of opinion among, between each other as to how to oppose it.
Sure.
As well. I think that's just my speculation. I could be wrong.
Sure, definitely. I mean, that takes us to, I think, the online sphere as a whole, right, in the English language, or at least between these three countries. And, you know, a lot of people, I think their experience is that there is quite a lot of dragging going on, quite a lot of infighting, bickering, name-calling, even slander sometimes in the online sphere. And you and I have talked about how unappealing that is and almost alienating that can be, especially for new Muslims. Right? And they come into and they have such good hope in sort of this new ummah. We say these things. I like to say that Muslims know all the right things to say, you know, unity and the ummah and the family and all this stuff. But then the reality, how people act, is sometimes different, right? You're having people competing for market share, even more so on the online sphere, you know, accusing each other of bid'ah, accusing each other of, you know, the culture wars is another sort of, you know, delineation. You're a simp. No, you're right or something like this. We've got nice names. We call each other.
We're replicating the arguments between the left wing and the right wing amongst non-Muslims.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what can you say about how we can get out of this? Because it seems to be something that is, as the broader society is being torn apart, you know, by the gender wars, let's say, or the culture wars in general, in addition to other stressors, it seems like it's also infiltrating into the Muslim community. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack. So I think that there's been two approaches by Muslims generally in both UK and across the Western world where Muslims live. So you live in a majority non-Muslim society, but it's not just a society of non-Muslims. It's they have a way of life or a deen, and it's based on what they call the Western Enlightenment ideals, individualism, and its political application, liberalism, and. Other schools of thought, which are similar or branches of or have shared the same creed, so Muslims have been, I suppose, initially, you know, deer in headlights when they probably came to these shores. What to do about this way of life? And they barely understood it themselves. Liberalism, what's that exactly? Mm-hmm. You know, many people, if you say define liberalism, maybe even many non-Muslims would struggle to actually give a definition of it too. And so then Muslims have been struggling to find a consensus about how to, where to draw a line in the sand and how to oppose. Because on the one hand, I think they are concerned that, well, we live in a very permissive cultures where things which are prohibited in Islam are permitted in the wider society. So if you appear to be too stern, or too restrictive, or activate the haram police button, you know, at the drop of a hat, people might be, there's a concern that people might be pushed away from you, that you get viewed to be caustic and abrasive and generally unwelcoming. But then on the other side of that, there's the concern that not calling out what we need to call out amongst not denouncing the liberal ideology and those who follow it, and warning Muslims, including Muslims who might inadvertently have adopted that ideas, because we're raised in that society, just by a type of osmosis, mm-hmm. you could say that many of us have inculcated the liberal ideas just because we were born in a liberal society, watching TV when we were young, coming from such backgrounds, especially for reverts. So many argue that we have to be stern and write refutations and be bold and also then be unapologetic about it, the Sharia and you know the hikmah of mm-hmm. Islam. Whereas the camp that is obviously don't be too stern might want to shy away from areas of conflict. So, for example, they might want to shy away from discussing aspects of the Sharia that the liberal society deemed to be
right.
a little bit shocking in their perspective, or something that they disagree with. Now, you know, there are tactics and there are means, and, you know, like you can have, you also have it on extreme. You have, for example, Anjem Chowdhury, who in the UK, who actually Muslims disliked in the UK, even though, you know, Muslims were very open about defending Islam and talking about those things. Because Anjem Chowdhury would basically not really explain the hikmah of thing of Islam, but he would just simply say the most inflammatory things deliberately to make the wider population angry. And the right-wing newspapers loved him.
Sure,
and the news outlets, they loved him. They gave him so much airtime. He took, like, they even helped them take great pictures of him outside you know, Big Ben. Yeah, we'll take it over. And all this kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah. You know, so you have that. And of course, the other extreme was Majid Nawaz, who kind of, you know, was used as a puppet for Prevent, and was advocating liberalism and a reformation, or what we call deformation, of Islam. So what I would say is that what Muslims faced in the West concerning both, you know, not being too stern and pushing people away, and there are certain wisdoms in applying attack, not always being stern and serious with people in a way that makes them want to run away from you, in terms of interpersonal charisma, interpersonal, you know, being sociable. But at the same time, there's something to be saying to make things clear. Mm-hmm. So how do you now balance all these things together, you know, is a question that Muslims are grappling with. Yeah. I think in the United States of America, that is a question. So I think how to deal with this, and what we need to deal with, is we need to stop Muslims from, because many Muslims, I think, are honestly just don't know what to do in such a circumstance. Mm-hmm. And they might get attacked by either side, mm-hmm. of these, let's say, perspectives, for either compromising or for being unwise. And what we need is we need to educate Muslims, we need to help Muslims to find that balancing act of both hikmah, but mm-hmm. not compromising at the same time, but also to stop Muslims advising each other in ways which are unhelpful, and by that, by publicly attacking each other, mm-hmm. And using tactics which are not helpful, and actually might be breaches of adab, like, sure. for example, derogatory name calling, mm-hmm. Or misrepresentation, or speculating of people's motivations, mm-hmm. although that happens across the board generally. These things kind of destroy any prospect of Muslims having a reasoned internal conversation that would help us reach a mature ijma, you could say.
No, that's very significant, especially, I think, with the online sphere. I think there's something of a slip of standards, right? Instead of, you know, some sort of structure such as a masjid, you know, which they're very, very imperfect institutions, but there's a sort of process by which there's, you know, credentials, and you get to a certain station through something, you know, we can critique that as well. But the point is that there's a slip even for that in the online sphere, in which anybody with a webcam, you know, can now get on, say things, you know, blast people, whatever. And it could be great entertainment, right? It could be great entertainment and get very, very popular. So how do we, this is something that I've had discussions with other imams in the States. How do we institute standards among ourselves? Because I completely agree. I think that we're getting in our own way and holding ourselves back from actually resolving some of these issues. Like, the point is not to make anyone feel better or pat anyone on the back or let anyone get away with anything. The point that I always come back to is the concept of loyalty that I believe Muslims have to each other. And loyalty begins with wanting guidance for the other one and wanting the other's redemption. That's something I take axiomatically. So if we want to conspire in bir, right, conspire in goodness and in goodwill towards each other, to try to maximize the likelihood that people are going to be redeemed and guided and resolve these sorts of issues, how do we reassert standards or change the conversation or take people by the hand and demonstrate that there's perhaps a better way to be doing this?
Well, so let's be clear about our aims. If given enough time, if Muslims have a productive internal discussion, they can eventually reach the conclusions they need to reach that would maximize both maintaining a non-compromising stance, but also maintaining hikmah in how you convey it. Now, but that can only happen when Muslims are free to have a safe conversation with each other, mature and respectful and with loving intent. Things that disrupt that kind of hold up this process of reaching this ijma that we want them to reach. And this is where you have acrimonious invective thrown at each other, attacking people's reputations, perhaps slander, perhaps, you know, rumor and hearsay. And again, I'm not thinking of any one particular individual or one organization. I've seen it multiple in 15 years of my kind of public work. I've seen it in a whole number of places, even in the UK, too. So we need to resolve that. And so how do we resolve it? We go back to the Quran and Sunnah. And I know everyone says this, but what does it mean? We need practical, specific, technical solutions from the Quran and Sunnah. So the Quran gives us, basically two things of use in relevant to this matter. One, we have a code of conduct. You know, we have adab and akhlaq. It doesn't mean anything to anybody. It's not like subjective. There is objective things that we agree on. So for example, everyone would agree that you shouldn't insult each other's mothers. Everyone agrees that you shouldn't lie about someone's, what they're doing. Everyone agrees that you shouldn't speculate or with no evidence about someone negatively. Everyone agrees that husn al-dhan is a thing, that you should assume the best from your brother and sister unless you have clear evidence otherwise. So these are all things that we agree on. You know, as much as Muslims have aqidah debates, or they debate politics, they agree on the Sharia aspects of adab, akhlaq, and even the political aspects of the political laws of Islam. We have so much agreement on that, more than any other religion or ideology could ever claim to. So why not then use that, implement that? Because if we don't, Muslims are going to see Muslims attacking each other online, being rude, being immature, accusing each other. And it not only demoralizes them, but it makes them question the practicability of Islam itself. And maybe, in extent, whether Islam is actually a true way of life from the Creator. Because surely, if the Creator gives us a way of life, it must be very practicable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if they don't know how Islam can be practiced, it could cause them to have doubts, as well as the demoralization is that when they see that the Muslim thought leaders, whether you call them scholars or du'at or whoever, thought leaders, if they're not benefited by Islam, then how can Islam give benefit to the Ummah? Mm. If they themselves have more knowledge and it doesn't benefit them,
right?
How does Islam benefit the Ummah then, who have less knowledge, presumably? So the first is that we have a code of conduct that is defined, and to realize that we share this code of conduct. We all actually agree. The second is the Quran tells us that if there's two sides disputing, they refer to a third party judge who will judge by the Quran and Sunnah. So what we need, and of course, there's another verse you want to bring about, like people not believing rumors and things, but if they had referred it to the authorities who could do the correct investigation. Now, of course, we don't have an Islamic political authority in existence today. If we did, this would be much more simpler. But what we can do as an ummah is we can attempt to institute an impartial fact-finding institution that would help adjudicate these disputes. You could almost say like an online Islamic court, you could say,
right,
where Muslims could have recourse to. And, we've discussed this already. I've been working for a couple of months with a number of other stakeholders on such a thing, primarily for the reason to stop the fitna that's happening, stop the demoralization of Muslims, but also to show Muslims that Islam is imminently practicable and can actually solve problems very efficiently. And so what Muslims need to see is, instead of they having a choice between one person that attacks this other person, or one person that attacks them back or denies, and they each make rival claims, they need to have, they need to see a organization that will fact check the claims, look at the evidence, juxtapose it with the Quran and Sunnah, and then be able to issue judgment based on the Quran and Sunnah, where people can't dispute that. And the important of this, the most important thing is credibility. Credibility is the only thing that could ever make that work. The slightest suspicion that it's being biased or prejudiced, it won't work. So I've been working on such a project with a few stakeholders who approached me. And we discussed this. It was based on, it was partially based on they observing that I did a similar kind of project on a small scale to a university in Canada when an MSA asked for help because they were being accused of being racist and sexist.
Yes.
And so they needed help. And I said, okay, well, I'm not going to come to your help just because you called me, but I can do an impartial investigation on it. But my conditions are that if I discover that you have been racist and sexist, you must apologize for it and own up. But if, of course, that's not the case, then the investigation should exonerate you. And my second requirement was that they give me access to all their communications, all their evidences, everything they have. They gave me unstinting access. And then when I wrote the report in a fact-based way, we used no emotive language. It used no judgmental language. It was simply like a police report, really, or right. like a narrative, a chronology of events you see in court in a court case describing a particular set of events. It was completely dispassionate, completely factual, also, when it would quote things, it would quote it in context with a full screenshot where the reader can see the full context of where the quote comes from and so on. So when I published that and what turned out that was the MSA actually weren't racist and sexist. It was left-wing Muslims at the university were using the accusation of racism and sexism as a weapon to argue for various left-wing ideologies which the MSA were kind of blocking or were resistant to. So because of the success of that report, it actually was 380 pages.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
But the success of it was that no one could deny what the report revealed, because it was factual. It was just, this is what happened, and here's the quote, and here's the full quote in context. It couldn't be disputed. And of course, when the report didn't just list the events, but it said, okay, this student said, use this term of intersectionality, or they use this term white fragility, or what have you. This comes from this thinker, this book, this comes from this ideology here, and I linked it, and then I juxtaposed it with the Quran and Sunnah, such that, again, it revealed both what motivated these left-wing students, where they got their ideas from, the specific books and thinkers, which some of them even mentioned by name themselves, and then what ideologies these books and thinkers are kind of part of, or which stream they come from, and then how these things contradict clear-cut hadith and Quranic ayah, such that, again, no one could argue against it, no one could dispute it. So in light of that, I was approached, in essence, say, well, that works so well with such a small thing concerning MSA. Could that be replicated to resolve disputes between public figures and speakers? And so we looked into it, and I kind of saw that, well, actually, in many cases, actually easier. But in other cases where there's accusation that, oh, this person or this organization is liberal, or this organization is Marxist, or this organization, what have you, that's also something I have now experienced in in investigating. And I could objectively assess that, whether this, you know, if this organization has been consciously involved in certain ideological proselytization, which on things which are obviously from ideologies which are not Islamic. So we kind of came up with the idea was to call it HISPA, because, as you know, HISPA just means accounting, from Yom Hisab, you know, Hisab, which is just Hisab is for account, accounting, and it's to hold people to account. Now, like, okay, you can't punish people and for under ta'ziyah punishments or send them to the
sure judicial, but it's more like arbitration, you could say.
Yes, its aim will be two things. One, to clear up for the public the disputes they're seeing, so they can see, okay, here's factually the case. Mm-hmm. And that was also inspired by these fact-checking organizations and institutions that, but they have fact-checking websites where if some false news has been reported, they usually dispel these false news, or this is actually a rumor, or there's no evidence for this, this is what really happened, or this image doesn't come from this event, but it came from actually 10 years ago and it's been reused. So Muslims need that.
Yes. Yeah.
And they also need to see how the adab and akhlaq of Islam is practically applied. So how can we say objectively that speaker has crossed the limits adab and akhlaq? And that's very, very important.
Because right now it's very impressionistic and very subjective, right? Yeah. Like, in fact, just look in the comments of any spicy video and you'll see people going back. We say, oh, so-and-so played the adab card, right? And then people respond, oh, no. And then it never really ends in any sort of thing conclusive. So it seems like this would add some authority and some conclusion to those sorts of maneuverings. Rather than being weaponized, basically just to punish and prove that your side is right, it's actually going to be impartial. And I think from what we discussed, because we discussed this a little bit offline, it also gives a chance for redemption, which I believe, you know, the Sharia is very much, compared to Western law, let's say, much more structurally interested in redemption than Western law. So there are sort of opportunities for the person who maybe did step out of bounds to turn back and to redeem themselves in public in honorable ways. So maybe you can walk us through sort of how this would work, or a test case, silly example or something like that, just to make it clear to people.
Sure. Okay, so as I said, I think it's very important because, you know, many Muslims have seen these debates, and I've done debates myself with atheists. Mm-hmm. And the argument that we use against atheists is that in atheism, in theory, since there's no God and there's no meaning to the universe, there's no good and bad. Mm-hmm. So technically speaking, anything goes. You can do anything you want as long as you have a material justification for it. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you know, in a materialistic universe, the only thing, the good and bad, just becomes what is possible and impossible. And that's the only aspect. Right. That's the only thing that remains. So does Islam have a moral system that is not subjective? Because if it does, then how are we any different to atheists?
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, to kind of get into kind of the nitty gritty of it, the how it would work. So in essence, there's two components to the institution that I want to set up, this HISPA or HISPA Online. One is the part which will be the fact checking, the investigative part. And the second part will have a council of scholars. And their role is to issue an authoritative judgment. Because us laymen, we can't give such judgments. We're not qualified to. So, even in Islamic courts in the past, the judge might ask for the shurta, the police, to go forth and investigate the facts of the case and verify the facts of the case, so that then the judge can just review the actual facts of the case.
Of course,
because they don't have time to do the investigation. So that's where you could say, I will come in, and others like me, where we will, someone will initially raise a complaint. It could be anybody. It doesn't have to be the person that's aggrieved. So someone could say that, oh, I saw this guy being attacked by this other guy, or I saw this rumor being said, and I don't like it, I want to raise a complaint. We'd ask, they'll submit it via complaint form. So we triage it, see is it something that is valid. You know, if someone just says, oh, I think this guy is wearing a funny hat, I don't like it, it's like, well, that's not really an issue. But if someone says, well, this person has, let's say, called someone, a donkey. Okay, well, that's something then. And there's screenshots and things. Okay, well, that can be investigated. So then the first phase would be that once we triage and see, is there a case or some case or the potential for a problem?
It's like standing. almost like, does this case have standing?
Does it have some standing? Yeah. Then we on the we're on the first recourse, we'd go to the individual who's being complained of, and we say to them that, look, there's a complaint that's been raised about you. We'll do this offline, you could say. Mm. With an official email be sent, but it won't be broadcast to the public. And they'll be given an opportunity to either defend what they said or to retract and apologize. We call it to self-rectify. And if they retract and apologize, then no further action will be taken, and nor will anyone be informed that they were approached by HISPA. And they can ideally they should do so out of sincerity. But for those people who might just want to, who are maybe not so sincere, or they have other motivations, competing motivations, it gives them a chance to save face. If they say, no, I will stand by what I said or what I did, And it's only things that they've said or did intentionally in public, not what they did in private. People's private lives are not within the remit of HISPA. It's not subject to investigation. What Allah conceals, right, is no one's job to reveal. So if they defend what they did, we'll move on to a full-on investigation. We'll go to all their public accounts and everything all records of their public accounts, whether it's on archive.com or something like this, we'll see with what they said. And then we'll compile a report, just be a fact-based report. On this date, this person said this. On this date, they said that. Screenshot will be included, the full screenshot in context. On this video, they said X, Y, and Z, maybe a transcript, and so on and so forth. And then once all the facts are gathered, we'll bring some Quran and ahadith which might seem to demonstrate a contradiction between their actions and what the Quran and Sunnah commands, and then will be presented to the individual and said, firstly, are all the facts accurate? Is there anything missing? Has anything been misconstrued or misrepresented? You can amend all that now, mm-hmm, right? So, mm-hmm, are you happy that this report is a accurate depiction of the facts? So yes, okay, I have no argument with it. Okay, do you have a response to these Quranic verses or ahadith? Like, do you know of a scholar's exception that you are following? Do you say, well, I believe that you can mock the Ahl al-Bidah, and I think that these people are Ahl al-Bidah. I say, okay, mock, but what do you mean by mock? And, show me the fatwa that you're following. And in this case, for example, there's no permission to insult the individual per se, but you can use a reductio ad absurdum where you show the absurdity or the absurd conclusion of the other person's argument. So right, that's fine. Right. Mm-hmm. But to attack the individual as an ad hominem, is that allowed? So then if they insist that it is, then say, all right, then we have to take it to the scholars, and the scholars will assess both your claim that you're following this fatwa, and they will have knowledge greater than ourselves about niche fatwas and ikhtilaf, and they can bring that in and issue judgment. But before we go to the scholars, we say, look, once we've got these facts and it does look like it could contradict this Quran and Sunnah that we've brought, do you want to apologize? A second time we offer, do you want to apologize yourself? If you do so, no further action will be taken. No one will know that, mm, we approached you, mm, and you can either do it because you're now convinced of the error of your ways, or you want to save face. That's up to your heart. We won't look into what motivates you. But for either way, do you want to apologize now to the public? Own up to what you did, say it was wrong, apologize for it, or to the individual that you also that was involved in it if you attack someone. And if they say yes, well and good. If they say no, then it progresses to the scholars. Then it will be referred to the scholars for judgment. And if the scholars then look into it and they see that this is actually a problem, and we indict that person, we will approach that person a third time, mm-hmm, and say, that would be the usual case, though it depends how egregious it is, but we'll put the person even a third time and say, the scholars have ruled against you. They've given this ruling here based on some evidences that they might know of and so on. If the person says, actually, I didn't know this, okay, you know what? I'm sorry. And okay, mm-hmm, you can apologize. You can self-rectify. No one will know that HISPA spoke to you. But if they say, nope, I will not, in a Don Giovanni way, if they say, nope, I will not, take it back. And when you say repentete, no, and I say no. Okay, and if they don't, then the report, all the facts that were gathered, the Quranic verses and ahadith, and the scholars' verdict will all be published online for everyone to see. And a video will be done which summarizes what it was. And in a sense, it's a kind of name and shame approach. And no one will be able to argue against it or to say, oh, it's impartial, whatever, because, again, the person in question checked the facts.
Right.
They weren't misrepresented. Right, the Quranic verses and Sunnah will be used. If the person is from Ahl Sunnah, they will accept the Ahl Sunnah sources.
Right,
they won't dispute them. Of course, there might be issues with some hadith that are being daif, but that's something the scholars can take into account. Of course, if the scholars unanimously agree that this person has breached the adab and akhlaq, obviously that Islam requires, then they will be named and shamed. But more importantly, the ummah will be educated.
Right, yes.
They'll see, you can't do that action because of these evidences. You know, because people often say they have a special exemption or exception to the rule. No, the scholars might educate otherwise. And that's what I think is, that's what convinced me, because I thought to myself, look, I don't have time for this. Right?
Of course, yeah.
And I've stayed out of online fitness for a long, long time because I just don't have the time to investigate, because I wouldn't be able to comment unless I actually spend time investigating everything. But when it was, someone said to me, look, the Muslims will learn from this. They will learn, you will improve their knowledge of adab and akhlaq by seeing practical examples, showing them practical examples and how the scholars addressed it, so that then Muslims can know, then that's too far. I will know to maintain that as a limit now. Whereas before, it was a bit of a gray area for me in my knowledge.
Yes.
And because of that, I agreed to kind of undertake this endeavor and so on. And of course, if the scholars judge that the person's actions were fine or okay or excusable or not haram, that would be published too, and they'll be exonerated from it. But there are other issues that can be discussed. Not just maybe one person complains, but someone could come saying, look, I've been slandered,
right?
And I have evidence to show that this rumor against me is verifiably false. And maybe the rumor doesn't have any identifiable source. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then we can then investigate if they invite, because the MSA of UBC in Canada, they invite me to investigate the claims against them. So you people can seek recourse instead of going to Western law courts and paying lots of money.
Sure.
Right. And to sue or civil suits, they can use this institution as a recourse to protect their reputation.
Which is much more in line with the Sharia, which historically and traditionally has always been open access, easy access for public. And I really am excited about that dimension that convinced you the education of the public, because one of the things, and Halak points this out in his books, that the sort of traditional ummah pre-colonialization had achieved was a common language of the Sharia, right? Like through the easy access of courts and the juridical sort of apparatus, everybody knew sort of how these things worked. Like they knew what the limits were. They knew what evidence was accepted or not accepted. They were at least literate, right, in these sorts of things. And that's a literacy that we've lost. It's a literacy that we've lost. We're now illiterate with this type of thing. I think it's a brilliant idea. And it demonstrates not just a familiarity with qada, which I notice, from someone who studied in Sharia, and the processes and almost the almost boring methodical nature of a qadi, but I also notice that that, as we said, it has that redemptive dimension. It's very transparent, and it just is profoundly fair. Now, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Notorious Face. It's an organization that attempted to investigate supposedly predatory behavior from imams. And I remember hearing complaints. I haven't done a thorough investigation of it, but I remember hearing complaints that people wouldn't learn that they had were under investigation until the whole thing was done. Mm-hmm. Now you tell me how profoundly it just goes to show. We've been talking a lot this week together in Canada about activism and the importance of rooting activism in the Sharia, rooting activism in Islam. We're not taking secular frameworks. We're not taking ideological frameworks as our basis, slapping some Islamic language on it and calling it Islamic. No, that actually is going to ruin us, right? So if we're going to investigate anybody, it has to be according to the Sharia. Right? It has to be according to the Sharia norms. It can't be a witch hunt. It can't be something that's inspired from the Me Too movement or Believe Every Woman or these sorts of slogans that get thrown around that just don't. They completely contradict. To be frank, they completely contradict the Sharia. And we have these things on the books. It's very easy for anybody with basic training to be able to access this literature, the Qadat literature, the procedures. Conflicts of interest, right? How to avoid conflicts of interest. We have loads and loads of literature about when the Qadi shouldn't judge, when he's hungry, when he's angry, when, if he has a commercial interest, if he has, how the Qadi should behave, that he shouldn't accept a gift, right? Mm-hmm. Even there's some of the ulama, they have a blanket prohibition about Qadha accepting gifts from anybody in their village. Because then what happens when it's time for arbitration? You're going to feel a different sort of way. Mm. So the Sharia is just profoundly fair and profoundly meticulous, and I really see that in how you and the other stakeholders have kind of approached this thing. And I wish you success. And I really hope that Allah puts barakah in this, because I do feel that it's a much needed thing. Go ahead.
You mentioned actually a conflict of interest. So there's
yes, I was gonna
there's
ask.
Perhaps a question that the audience watching this right now.
Right.
Would ask, which is, how do you stop biased judges?
Yes.
So there's two things, two elements that we're implementing. One is the council of judges are going to be multi-denominational, right? So they're going to come from different manhajs and jamaats and halakas across the board and from multiple countries. Any judge that has any affiliation with anyone who's being investigated, or whether they have an animus against them, a personal animus, like they've been attacked by that person before, they don't like that person, or they are the person being investigated, they are sympathetic to, they have a degree of sympathy to, they are to be recused. They are to be, as in, removed from the council for that particular case. So that was the kind of the two elements. One will be that anyone who has a connection, a conflict of interest, will be removed from any adjudication of it in a particular case. And of course, the council itself will be multi denominational. You could say, quote unquote, it'll be from Salafis, Sufis, and different jamaats and so on and so forth. Of Ahlul Sunnah, in order that that when they reach an ijma, it carries that much more authority. And as I said, credibility is key here, because maybe if there was only Salafis on board,
of course,
a Sufi wouldn't accept their judgment. And if it was only Sufis on board, the Salafi wouldn't accept their judgment. But if a Salafi or a Sufi knows that there's at least one or two or three scholars that they respect on that panel, then, and they know that there was an ijma between them, then they're going to respect it and give it some attention. So that's a key element. And as you said, transparency, all our procedures, policies, and so on will be published online. So in theory, you could replace me with anyone else. And as long as they follow those procedures, you'd come with the exact same outcome. So if someone raises a complaint about myself or anything I publicly say, there will be someone that will be investigating me using the same methodology, and I'll be given the same treatment as anyone else would be. And also, it's also the complaint procedures is first come, first serve. So although with some, you could say an algorithm of some kind, like for example, if one individual has complained with, the first 500 complaints, and there's that one individual's being complained with the first 200 of them, but there are like, then the rest is all a mix. We say, okay, we can't just spend the next 100 or 200 complaints just as one guy. Mm-hmm. So we'll pick maybe four or five, and then alternate to some other organization or whatever, and then or person, then alternate between different individuals to try to get as many people as possible, because I know that there's a concern that what if someone gets to the complaint page first and just starts spamming, right? Yeah, sure. So we've thought it out very meticulously, so that credibility is key, because there's no credibility, then it completely collapses.
Of course. Just a couple of questions, and then we'll probably wrap up. It's getting a bit late here. Mm-hmm. What if an ijma can't be reached by the scholars that will make a judgment if the need arises?
Well, if an ijma can't be reached, it will be because there will be a scholar or two that will present some past precedent, and that is required, where they say that, no, this behavior is allowed in such a circumstance. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, because the organization must be must be non-sectarian, as in neutral, and only going based on what is commonly agreed amongst right. Muslims,
okay.
That's the most important. Then no indictment can occur on an individual.
So it establishes a baseline, so that's important, right? So we're trying to establish a hard floor for the adab and conduct between du'at and scholars and alims and just whoever else. That's very good. So what if someone accuses someone of bid'ah, okay, and that this basically attempts to, it shifts the nature of sort of the procedures, right? And that's might be subjective, because we're talking, you want to avoid sectarianism, you want to have a ecumenical, if you will, panel of scholars, but the very label or ascription of someone as being mubtadi or not is along those sectarian lines. So how would a situation like that unfold?
Oh, so that's a good question. And we have measures in place for that. So basically, because Hisba is not going to be rooted in any particular school of thought, but where Muslims unanimously agree on what adab and akhlaq looks like. So if someone calls someone Ahl al-Bidah, or you're from Ahl al-Bidah, or you're Mubtadi' because you believe in a particular school of aqidah, right? Mm-hmm. This would be judged to be what we call a good faith claim, as in the person accuses that other person in sincerely, because they believe that, look, according to my adopted creeds, I think you are Ahl al-Bidah. I'm not saying it to insult you. I'm not saying it to disparage you. It's my true belief that I hold. No one could say, look, it's my true belief that you're a donkey.
Right.
Okay. Right. So in that sense, then there could be no investigation, because that would be a matter of ikhtilaf,
it's out of jurisdiction.
It's out of jurisdiction. But what Hisba can investigate is if someone says, this person claims that LGBTQ practices are fully permissible in Islam, and they are Ahl al-Bidah for this.
Right.
But the person never said any like that, nothing like that. Or this person says Marxism is compatible with Islam, and they didn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
Then what Hisba can investigate is that the factual part of the claim,
sure,
which is that, well, if the person didn't say that Marxism is compatible with Islam, then that's false. And so because you called them Ahl al-Bidah based on that allegation,
right,
both your allegation and your description of that person as Ahl al-Bidah are both false, which you must retract. And that's how we'd approach it.
I see. Is there any space for something like a class action suit? Like you brought up a situation where someone could have 500 complaints about one person, and sometimes before we've seen situations where perhaps there wasn't enough evidence to corroborate one single complaint, but if you start to see a pattern of complaints from different sources, that might legally mean something different. Is there anything that you've thought about along those lines?
Well, I mean, like if an individual action they do is not a breach of adab al-akhlaq per se, then just because he does it 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, doesn't make it egregious, although it depends on the nature of the fiqh and what have you, but then that would require all the scholars to agree, right?
Sure.
However, there is one issue that people often ask, which is in Islam, if you mean well for a brother or a sister, you advise them privately.
Right.
And you get them to correct their own behavior without going in public, because they might be more resistant to correcting themselves if you go public first, which is the reason why HISPA actually gives people at least 2 to 3 chances to self-rectify and to apologize without and save face. So some Muslims might say, well, I'm going to invoke the, you know, the forbiddance of munkar and according to ma'ruf, and that because that person said something I find objectionable in public, I'm going to respond to that person in public. Now, is that technically haram if it is indeed correct that that person did say something that is objectionable? Well, no, it's not haram per se, but there's a preference, you could say. You could argue that it's mandub, it's more it's recommendable and more pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that you approach the individual that you find objectionable what they've said first privately, get them to rectify themselves privately, and if they don't, then going publicly. Now, in that situation where there might be an individual Muslim who says that, look, I'm calling to the good and forbidding evil because I want to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and I want to attain his pleasure, but I'm not going to pick the option that does the same thing in effect and but attains more of his pleasure.
Right.
No, I'm going to just go straight to public attacks and not even going to ask them privately, sorry, to advise them privately. I mean, what can be noted is that it could be made public that this individual does that and where they could have taken a recourse that is more pleasing to Allah.
I see. So we're saying that the conclusion that might be drawn, right, from the organization, from HISPA, might not always be so clear-cut, black and white as to, you know, this should have been fully, this is a clear breach, right, and or that this person's completely exonerated. There could be maybe a middle ground in some scenarios where it's like, okay, this might, strictly speaking, it might not, you know,
It's not a breach of adab and akhlaq, but it could have been done better.
Yes. I see.
Or it could have been done in a way more pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or more efficacious, right? So that could be noted to the public, but it's not an indictment. It's more like, because as Muslims, we should be striving to do the most recommended things we can.
Yes.
Not saying, well, if it's not strictly haram, I'm going to do it.
Right.
And it's like, well, okay, but you should be avoiding the makruh and you should be pursuing what is mandub ideally.
Yes. Right.
If you're aiming to seek Allah's pleasure, if that's your sole concern, then why wouldn't you? Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those will be things which HISPA might mention. That it's not an indictment, but it could have been done better. Mm-hmm. Something else is that this is a typical problem amongst Muslims, but maybe amongst non-Muslims too. The assumption behind people's motivations.
Yes, of course.
A Muslim might not give husn al-dhan to their fellow brother or sister, even when they're meant to give husn al-dhan to their fellow brother and sister. Now, someone might say, well, I'm going to assume the worst possible motivation behind someone's mistake or action. Because it is possible, and I think there's more evidence to support it. And I say, yeah, but there's also a possibility that they did things by accident. There's a saying which is, never attribute to malice what can be better explained by ignorance, right?
Yes, I know.
So someone might say, well, look, accusation that this person has a negative motivation,
right,
or an insincere motivation, is not, you can't disprove it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's unfalsifiable, really.
Yeah. But what HISPA can do when it investigates is that it can say, well, there's also plausible other explanation. And as a Muslim, it's recommendable for you to pick husn al-dhan to make excuses and to say, well, there's other possible explanation is possible. And in that case, you might not be able to do an indictment of that person for breach of adab akhlaq, but it can be noted that person didn't adhere to husn al-dhan requirements when an alternative explanation was possible. Sure, that person could be right in what they're saying, but they themselves have no certainty.
Yes.
And as the Quran says, that dhan does not avail on the truth. Speculation does not avail. And of course, beware suspicion as well. So these things can be noted. Of course, so scholars might not always just say, this is indictable. They might say, it's not indictable, but it could have clearly been done better and in a way that's more rewardable and pleasing to Allah. And so if an individual continually eschews the way that is more pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the public should be made to know about this. And maybe, inshallah, the person who keeps picking the the less recommendable road will feel the pressure, will feel shy and realize, yes, you know what, I should be picking what is more recommendable first. So, but that's not a condemnation. It's not meant to be naming and shaming, but it's a hope that Muslims will always pick the better of two roads.
And it's instructive. And as you said, I think that's one of the biggest benefits of it. We're instructing and teaching Muslims how to behave and what they should aspire to. I could come up with some technical questions, but I think we'll give it a rest. I think we'll end on that note. And I really ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless that initiative and all the initiatives that you do, and to make it a means of attaining His pleasure and His salvation, or your salvation from Him on the Day of Judgment, inshallah.
Ameen.
Thank you so much, Ustaz Abdullah. It's always a pleasure. Many great conversations, and I hope to have more before we part ways. But for now, we'll sign off. Fikum barakallah. Subhanakallah. Hamdaka. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta. Astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.